What would you do if you had to flee for your life from your homeland?
There's an implicit question in the novel. What would you do? You, person living in comfort and privilege and security and safety, and perhaps with the luxury of pronouncing judgment in an abstract way on some of these people who are trying to make it to our country, whom we have the luxury of regarding facelessly. Well, I really wanted to put faces and souls and personalities and longings and fears and shames and mistakes and aspirations to those faceless abstractions and ask my readers, what would you do? How would you survive?
That's Boris Fishman. We talk with him about his powerful novel of forced emigration, The Unwanted. Then from Riot Girls to Spice Girls and the backlash against feminism.
Producers are not going to give record deals to sort of feisty women making incredible music about sexual assault and reproductive rights. They're going to find some teenagers and put them on a stage and, sign a Pepsi deal. And that's exactly what happened. So there was this displacement of women who were making incredible music. And that's not to say that the pop stars, people obviously, they have many fans too, but it was this real displacement of women who had a very specific goal and were not afraid of saying what they wanted and who really were angry and wanted to see systemic change. And then these like highly sexualized teenagers came along and they pushed everyone else out the way.
That's Atlantic cultural critic Sophie Gilbert. She tells us about her book, Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a Generation of Women Against Themselves. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Boris Fishman emigrated from the former Soviet Union when he was a child. Up until now, his novels have centered on the immigrant experience. But his new novel, The Unwanted, comes at migration from a different angle. The experience of not settling in a new land, but of leaving one's old one under threat. The Unwanted is a story of migration, betrayal, and survival, set in an unnamed, war-torn country and moving to the perilous journey outward. Fishman explores how lies, meant to protect, can fracture a family, even in the face of collective trauma. It's a moving portrait of a child's resilience, a father's compromise, and a mother's reckoning, all raising one urgent question: what would you do to survive? Let's listen to my conversation with Boris Fishman now. Boris Fishman, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time, but it's great to be back. Thank you.
The Unwanted is a very different kind of book, I think, than your other books. It's a different venue. It still stays with the theme of migration, although I think the others were more about immigration, the experience of having immigrated. It's set in an unnamed, war-torn country. Why is that country not named?
Good point, by the way, about the fact that all the others are about coming and this one is about leaving. And of course, that was lodged in my subconscious. But believe it or not, it never quite reached consciousness until you just said it, which is the beautiful thing about sharing your book with readership, because they reveal your book and yourself back to you. So thank you for that. Why is the country unnamed? Several reasons. Number one, my point is that this can be anywhere. This can be Syria. This can be Russia. This can be the Palestinian territories. This can be any number of places in the world where the minorities without power are not protected by the majorities with power. And by minority, I just mean in a numerical sense, because the way in which the family in the novel is a minority is also not named, and very purposefully so. It doesn't matter what the distinction is. What matters is that they are the people without the power, and the question of, do the people with the power protect the people without, which is, I was imagining even though it's unnamed, I was imagining a country far away, but it turns out that it can be our country too. I really did not mean for it to be that topical, but it is. So in order to emphasize that question and that issue, I left the location unspecified. I was also inspired by J.M. Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians, which is a masterful work that is as topical today as when he wrote it, about what dying empires do in order to make themselves feel more relevant. And that book takes place in an unspecified empire and is no less trenchant for it. And I was very inspired by it as well. The other reason that the location is unspecified is that because I didn't want the story to be overdefined by anything that had happened in real life. I didn't want a reader to be distracted by the question of whether did this really happen this way during the Syrian civil war. And the third reason is that I didn't want anybody telling me what I could and could not write because I'm white or because I'm male or because I'm Jewish. As we all know, there's a very harmful trend in literature of telling writers what lanes they should be in and out of. And I think it's a very damaging trend because it is the job of a fiction writer to imagine lives unlike his own. And I wanted the freedom to do that without that interference.
Just parenthetically, it's interesting that you say that because I recently interviewed a Black author who would prefer to think of herself as a writer, not a Black writer, although she writes about Black issues as well. And so that, you know, I think that just underscores that it's not just about being white or being male, but about maybe the tendency of, you know, society to try to put people into boxes.
Yes, as human beings, we classify. It's a natural instinct. But there is also, I think, a trend in literary life. I'm purposefully leaving the sort of the antecedent unnamed. I'm not even sure where exactly it's coming from. But there's been this sense in literary life that sort of there are lanes and certain people belong in them and certain people belong outside of them. And what I wish the conversation were instead is an emphasis on the fact that if I, as a white male Jewish person, decided to imagine, I don't know, Muslim Palestinian lives in the territories, well, I have set myself a great task. That is a great challenge. That is a daunting challenge. And it's something that's very hard to do well. And I have no right to do it poorly. But I do have every right to try. My resistance is to the notion that you shouldn't try because you don't have a right to even to try. And the great likelihood, I guess, sorry, what I'm trying to say is that it's very hard to succeed in such a mission, and one ought to undertake it with great humility. It's a very difficult thing to get right, to write about lives unlike your own, with which you have no personal experience.
And that's one of the things that actually really struck me about this book, because you migrated to the United States from the former Soviet Union, Minsk, which happens to be where my mother's family is from, but came, you know, 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, at a time when to be a Soviet Jew fleeing the Soviet Union to the United States was a much easier task than the task of your characters in this novel, The Unwanted. They face a completely different reality. And yet there is, I mean, your description of the conditions that they face is so detailed. I just wonder, you know, how did you go about this task of putting yourself into the lives that you can only imagine?
I'm super gratified to hear that, and doubly so because I imagined all of it. I imagined all of it. And that's part of the reason this is a different novel for me from my previous books, also in the sense that there are no Russian or Jewish characters in it. I did not conduct a single interview with a family member for the purposes of this novel. I imagined everything that happens in it. So what you're saying is super gratifying, not least because I did my job well as a novelist, but doubly so because I leaned on no personal information. I sort of, you know, I read the newspaper like everybody else. I absorb the information in it. It gets tucked away somewhere. It sits there marinating and waiting to be called up as a novelist performs his task. And when I sat down to write, I did nothing more complicated but also nothing less simple or more simple than call up my imagination and what it had retained about the news we've all been living through for the past 10 or 15 years, and just try to empathetically, but not uncritically, imagine what these people might go through.
So let's not keep our listeners in suspense. Let's find out a little bit more about the novel. This is a country where there is, I think, as you have alluded, there's a minority sect that is prone to the abuses of the dominant sect. Tell us about your characters. This is a family: George, the father; Susanna, the mother; and Dina, who, when we first meet her, is their 8-year-old child.
That's right. So I wanted to avoid creating saints. I don't think refugees have to be saints in order to command our empathy and understanding. They just have to be human beings. And that's what these people are. George is an erstwhile poet who now makes his living teaching the poetry of the dominant sect in the second most significant state university, a state that is obviously overseen and dominated by members of the dominant sect. But he's tolerated there because he is a kind of bootlicker. He's a kind of collaborator. His fellow minority sect neighbors say, look how fast the dog runs to the bull behind his back, right? He's the kind of person who is ridiculed, but always privately and always quietly by the people around him because he's a sellout. But what he has managed to do by playing the game of the people who run this country is secure not only safety, but a degree of well-being and privilege for his family, which involves his younger wife, Susanna, and their daughter, Dina. And let's complicate the picture further by revealing that George is nowhere near as embarrassed as his neighbors are. He savors his power. He savors his access. It makes him feel important. It has replaced, to some extent, the role that poetry, that writing poetry, had used to play in his life. But the country is now in the fourth year of a civil war. And for reasons that I won't specify here, reasons that even the characters themselves don't have identical understanding of, the family's luck runs out, and George is no longer able to protect his family, and the time has come for them to flee.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Boris Fishman about his new novel, The Unwanted. Talk about the relationship between these characters, particularly George and Susanna, and Susanna and Dina. How does their relationship to each other change under the experience of migration? And maybe actually first talk a little bit about that experience of migration as you imagined it in this novel.
So I'll say only that the reason George gives Susanna for why they have to flee turns out to be an untruth, something that she slowly begins to piece together as the novel goes on. George's lie sets in motion a series of other lies by members of the family, always with the goal of protecting each other from the harmful truth about what's really going on, right? Sometimes in self-serving ways, sometimes in selfless ways, but a dominant element of the way they take care of each other, and this definitely comes from my own background. I come from a culture where the white lie is revered as a form of protection for one's loved ones. I think back to the fact that my grandfather, my beloved grandfather, who was ill with cancer for many years, never knew it because we saw it as our duty to protect him from that information, which would have sapped his will and his faith and his optimism and his hope, in our view, and in his. And so we had made as a family that unilateral decision to save him from that information. It's something that an American family would never do or would much more rarely do, but it's absolutely standard in the part of the world that I come from. And that is a quality and a characteristic that I gave to these characters. The problem is that these lies compound, making the situation that this family goes through worse and worse. And because of these lies, some of the characters in this family undergo terrible ordeals whose consequences psychologically never leave them for the rest of the novel and sort of pay forward in ways that begin to compromise Dina, the daughter, who engages in some of her own in order to survive, in order to make sense of what's going on, in order to protect her family, in order to elevate herself. She's also not a saint. And I guess my point is simply that it's to focus on the way in which the members of this family tell lies in order to protect each other and how these lies slowly destroy them as a family, even after they make it to safety, because the moral compromises such people have to make in order to find safety and dignity in the impossible situations in which they find themselves have a tremendous cost. And it's a cost that I want readers to be aware of, not least because there's an implicit question in the novel. What would you do? You, person living in comfort and privilege and security and safety, and perhaps with the luxury of pronouncing judgment in an abstract way on some of these people who are trying to make it to our country, whom we have the luxury of regarding facelessly. Well, I really wanted to put faces and souls and personalities and longings and fears and shames and mistakes and aspirations to those faceless abstractions and ask my readers, what would you do? How would you survive? Would you be as smart and heroic as resourceful and resourceful as these people, even as they make mistake after mistake and engage in deception? That is the question between the lines. The one other thing I want to add is I haven't really gotten to talk much about Dina. She's a very special character, and for me, the most important one in the novel. Not only because she almost shares an age with me when I immigrated, but because there is an incredible impishness about her and the way she moves through the world that for me was the engine that took me through the creation of the novel. I wanted to observe how this child not only made sense of what was going on with her, but the kind of subterfuge and creativity she engaged in, not only to make sense of it, but to transcend it. It's her novel.
Well, that's beautifully described. I think you described Dina beautifully there. And what also strikes me is that these are people who are making these decisions in a situation in which they are completely powerless and subject to the capricious, you know, for good or ill, the capriciousness of others. You mentioned before that you did not have the U.S. in mind when you wrote this book, but now it has become much more relevant. So I wonder if you could talk more about that and how you are, you know, processing the what's going on around us now.
Well, I struggle to find language to describe what's going on around us now. It feels like a slow motion nightmare. And it feels like in the adopted country to which we fled as a beacon of hope and justice and fairness, we're living through political behavior that in some cases would put the Soviet Union to shame. And I, perhaps like many others, am reeling in ways that go far beyond the relevance of my novel and very, looking for the right adverb and I can't quite find it, I guess very disorientedly formulating some kind of resistance plan, as I think we all must. I don't know where the imagined leaders of this resistance have gone. I don't know where my political representatives have gone. They seem to have absconded from the national stage. Without drifting too far into politics, I'm seeing occur around me things that I thought were confined to what I imagined for the purposes of this novel. If you'd asked me, Boris, okay, the place is unspecified, but where is it? I would have said, well, it's somewhere east of Vienna, that's for sure. Maybe it's Eastern Europe, maybe it's Central Asia, maybe it's the Middle East, maybe it's North Africa, but like, you know, nowhere west of that. And it has leapfrogged over Europe to become relevant in my own country. I think we immigrated in 1988 to the America of Ronald Reagan, which to us Soviets was a representation of all that was right. For I think many liberals in this country, that was the beginning of the end. But for us at that time, that was the beginning of the beginning. That was the beginning of the future. But that country is unrecognizable from the vantage point of today. I don't think it's possible to have too much alarm about what's going on now. And if my novel happens to persuade an extra person or two of that, I would consider that a very noble achievement.
Well, Boris Fishman, it is a powerful novel, The Unwanted. It really, I think, brings home in a very personal way to the reader what it is like to be the unwanted in a society. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
The thanks is to you. Thanks so much for having me again. It was a pleasure.
Boris Fishman. In addition to The Unwanted, Fishman is the author of the novels A Replacement Life and Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo, as well as the memoir Savage Feast. He teaches creative writing and literature at the University of Austin in Texas. Go to writersvoice.net to read or listen to a sample from The Unwanted. Next up, how pop culture turned a generation of women against themselves. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. The backlash against women's rights has been getting fiercer in the last few years, from the loss of reproductive rights after the Dobbs decision, to the spreading of incel culture to the centers of political power. The position of women and girls is becoming ever more precarious. But the backlash was decades in the making, driven by forces that transformed pop culture from rebellion into reaction. Sophie Gilbert's new book, Girl on Girl, is a searing critique of how pop culture has shaped and undermined feminist progress. Gilbert analyzes the commodification of girl power, the rise of reality TV, and the mainstreaming of misogyny through social media and porn. Through sharp insight and personal reflection, Gilbert maps the cultural backlash against women and explores how women might reclaim agency and rewrite our story. Here's our conversation. Sophie Gilbert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Girl on Girl. This is a book very much about backlash, the backlash to the feminist movement, the backlash that seeks to overthrow the basic fundamental premise that women are people deserving of things like equality and respect. You say you wrote this book because you were truly stunned by the reversal of Roe v. Wade and by the tacit confirmation that progress for women is not and never will be linear. So you were stunned. Then what happened?
I mean, I think for much of my life, I had taken for granted the idea that things would always get incrementally better. For women, for people of color, for trans people, for just progress. I think after the election of President Obama in 2008, it just seemed like we were on an upswing for the human race. And then things started to go wrong. Obviously, Hillary Clinton lost the election to Donald Trump in 2016, and Me Too happened, and you had this really powerful outpouring of women's stories, and it was clear that things were not right at work. And then Roe v. Wade was overturned. And I remember in 2022, just for the first time, I suppose, naively really realizing that things could go in a backward direction as well. And, you know, other people were passing, I think, the politics of Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court. And there was an amount of good analysis, but it seemed to me that investigating culturally what had happened over the course of the last 20, 30 years might be an interesting project. And I had been doing that for much of my career anyway, as a critic at The Atlantic, and sort of trying to figure out the links between works of art and entertainment and identity and what culture teaches us, what it what it says to us, how it defines our dreams, our ambitions, our sense of self. And so I sort of had the idea very quickly for a framework for this book. And I knew that I wanted each chapter to be a different form of media. I knew I wanted it to go chronologically. There was a lot I didn't know, was surprised by. But otherwise, it sort of happened quite fast. And then in September, I think I was pitching it by September 2022. And then by December, it was sold. So then I had to write it.
And it is really a wonderful book. You write that culture, feminism, and history run on parallel tracks, informing, disrupting, and even derailing each other. I really had to think about that sentence. Unpack it for us.
I think people assume that sometimes that culture exists in its own universe. And there are obviously works of culture that are referencing things in politics and that seem to be inspired directly by the political moment. But especially with culture that is popular among women, it's often sort of derided as trashy, as unworthy of critical attention, as sort of being irrelevant, I think, if you're a serious person and you're trying to have serious thoughts about the world. But it's actually incredibly influential. I mean, if you look at something like reality television, for example, it has been sending women messaging for more than 25 years now. And very rarely is that messaging scrutinized more and more now, because we have much more quality. There's more debate online, I think, of the dynamics of certain shows. But in the beginning, it was sort of quite almost happening in a vacuum. And when I did my research for this book, it was sort of just funny how everything was connected and everything echoed, and not just different works of culture and different mediums, but you could almost see directly how what was happening in the world, what was happening in politics and health, was then having a real powerful influence on culture. I think the first thing that I figured out in the book, not that I was the first person to figure it out, but I had not figured it out for myself, was how much of an impact the AIDS crisis had on culture. And paradoxically, how it sort of had a double impact, because on the one hand, everyone was very anxious and very scared of sex. Like, suddenly sex was this very loaded issue. And what that meant was you had this sort of traditionalist impulse in culture that was very much like, go home, women. It was like good housekeeping ads. Go home and stay in your safe domestic sphere and don't enter the world because it's bad and scary out there. And then there was this also, at the opposite end of the spectrum, there was this sort of very sexualized aspect of culture that was sort of indulging the voyeuristic aspect of people's desires. It was saying, okay, maybe sex is dangerous right now, maybe sex is fraught, but you can still watch, you can still think about it. And so on that side of things, you had Madonna making a lot of like very pro-sex content. You had things like HBO's Real Sex in the 90s coming out. And they were sort of unapologetic, and they were saying, actually, we need to reclaim sex as a force for pleasure, as a force for good. We need people not to be ashamed of it, not to be afraid of it, to say that there are safe ways of sort of connecting with each other in this way. So you had these two very disparate things, but they were both very much happening in culture as a consequence of what was happening in public health. So things like that, I mean, there are so many different examples in the book, but when you start to notice them, the connections are very, very strong and surprising.
Yes, and something that really is, that you point to as at the heart of the kind of post-feminist backlash, is the whole mainstreaming of porn. And what you've just talked about, you know, there's a difference between being sex positive or promoting a healthy sexuality with equality and consent between men and women, and what we actually got, which is incredibly misogynistic.
Yeah, I have tried sort of so hard to make the distinction clear in the book, because I'm not anti-porn. I don't think all porn is bad. There are kinds of porn that are made by women that are made for women. I mean, obviously those are not the only kinds that we need, but there are kinds that are not like the misogynistic examples of it, I would say. But I have to be clear that when people go online now to porn sites, much of what they get almost immediately is very graphic. It is about dominance over women, and often it is violent in many ways. And I think this has pretty much been the mainstream in pornography now for a few decades, and that has had an impact on culture. Like, of course it has. It's had an impact on people's lives too, on the way that people live and love and relate to each other. But it's had a huge impact on culture, and I think it was really surprised me during my research for the book how much of an influence porn was throughout these past three decades. Like, how many of the questions that I had about what happened to women in the 21st century, they kept coming back to porn. Like, porn was always there. And so that was a part of the book that was difficult in so many ways, because I didn't want people to think I was sort of reflexively opposed to this thing. I just really wanted to study its significance and its influence. And that was sort of the project for me.
Yeah, I was interested. At a certain point, you talk about Madonna's 1992 book called Sex, and you contrast it to feminist artists. You named three of them that I knew personally quite well because they were close friends of my mother.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Hannah Wilke, Joan Semmel, and Carolee Schneemann. Well, my mother was part of that whole downtown New York Soho renaissance, and they were all part of, I mean, my mother included, she was a performance artist, were all part of critiquing and examining and interrogating the traditional views of women and contrasting them with different kind of power, including sexual power, but yeah, very different. And so I wonder if you say that in that shift, something significant happened between, you know, the shift between those folks in the early, in the 70s and the 80s and Madonna's book, Sex.
That's so incredible to hear. Yeah, I mean, there has always been, not always, but for a good few decades now, there's been a tradition of women using art to try to understand female desire and understand to what extent it's always been influenced, tempered by male sexuality. And so what fascinated me so much about those three artists was there's always the tension in their work about, can a woman present herself as a sexual subject without becoming an object for the male gaze? And I think I've sort of written about Madonna a lot in the past. I do think she's always someone who's been involved with the art world. She's always collected art. She came of age in that like New York 1980s scene. She obviously dated Basquiat. I do think she's a lot more thoughtful with her work than she's often given credit for. And so I do think with her coffee table book, Sex, it was such a scandal when it came out. People assumed that she was just making porn and she was just presenting herself as a porn star. But when that book came out when I was a child, so I did not experience it contemporaneously, but having gone back to look at it now as an adult, it is clear that she's sort of engaging with that tension. Like, can I present my fantasies, not my fantasies, Madonna's fantasies. Can she present her fantasies and her like experiments with sex and her sort of playing with the imagery of it without cheapening it or without people taking it as something it's not? And I think she succeeded with her project as much as she wanted to, but it was so enormously successful because of who she was, because of the profile that she had, that it mainstreamed kind of graphic portrayals of sex in a way that once that's happened and the genie is out of the bottle, I think it's very hard to put back. It just showed to people how much this kind of material would sell, like how much people wanted to see it in the 90s post-AIDS, like how much of a desire there was for this kind of imagery. And I think that informed a lot of what happened afterward in the 90s that was not at all in the same spirit of investigation and experimentation that Madonna was working within.
Yeah, it's the transformation from Riot Girl to Spice Girls that you explore. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting for me. The first chapter of the book is about music, and there were four developments in music, I should say, that really closely reflected developments in feminism at the same time. And on the one hand, you had this slogan, girl power, which when it was first spawned, it was part of the Riot Girl movement, this sort of punk movement, pro-women, trying to carve out space for fans, women who were fans of punk, who were often sort of derided and pushed to the back at shows. And it was Riot Girl was very political. It was really trying to advocate for women's rights, trying to advocate against sexual assault. It was very creative. Lots of women had zines. They would, you know, write poems and theses, and they would have manifestos for what they wanted to achieve. And it was like really animated by anger and by ambition. And then, of course, came along the Spice Girls in 1995, and they adopted girl power as a slogan for themselves. But it didn't really stand for anything. It was just kind of the way that they used it. It was just kind of like, girl power, we're here, we're present, we're loud, we're sexy, our clothes are great. You can buy anything. We've got 10 million branded products for you in Target. I mean, I should say I'm a huge fan of the Spice Girls, and I have been since I was quite young. But it wasn't really until I researched this chapter and saw how much the meaning of girl power changed from a kind of third wave feminist slogan to a post-feminist slogan. It seemed to embody so much more than just the band itself.
And talking about music, there's also the shift of hip hop. I mean, hip hop started as a very politically aware genre of music that was against racism, against the predations of white culture, celebrating black culture. But when it went mainstream, it pretty much just became violently misogynist. And with what you were just talking about before, I mean, you mentioned the commodification. I mean, so much of this seems to be connected, at least in the music industry, with the increasing dominance of the big corporations into music and into later on into art.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and it's so much the story of the book in so many ways. Like, once people figure out that a certain kind of culture is enormously profitable, enormously popular, it has to become sanitized. It has to become defanged in so many ways to be more popular, to sell more things, to sell more products. And so Riot Girl, which was never sort of palatable to mainstream America, you very quickly had producers seeing the explosive success of the Spice Girls. I think they sold something like $500 million worth of branding deals in their first year and a half as an act. And of course, when you see people making that much money, I mean, producers are not going to give record deals to sort of feisty women making incredible music about sexual assault and reproductive rights. They're going to find some teenagers and put them on a stage and, you know, sign a Pepsi deal. And that's exactly what happened. So there was this displacement of women who were making incredible music. And that's not to say that the pop stars, I mean, people obviously, they have many fans too, but it was this real displacement of women who had a very specific goal and were not afraid of saying what they wanted and who really were angry and wanted to see systemic change. And then these like highly sexualized teenagers came along and they pushed everyone else out the way. And in hip hop, of course, as you said, hip hop was very political. It was protest music. But after the LA riots in the 90s, it was, I think, deemed less commercially viable to have music that was railing against police brutality. And, you know, if you're protest music, you need something to protest against. And that, the figure that people agreed on, the figure that was suitable was unfortunately women. So that's one theory for why hip hop took such a misogynistic turn in the 90s. And to me, it does make sense.
Then Sophie Gilbert in Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a generation of Women Against Themselves. You also go on to write about reality TV. And I have a confession to make. I hate reality TV. I find it incredibly boring. So I've almost never watched it. But I learned a whole lot about it from this wonderful book. It really accelerated something. You say that at first it appeared that it was a democratization of some kind because it you know, highlighted so-called ordinary people, but instead it turned into something quite different. So talk about reality TV and its impact.
Gosh, there's so there's so many different aspects to talk about. And in some ways it's really not my specialty, I should say. Like, it was, I've written about culture for a long time, for sort of more than 15, 16 years now. But I had not written that much about reality television. I'd written an amount about Kim Kardashian because I find her fascinating. But it wasn't my sort of area of expertise. So it was fun to go back. And the thing that was really surprising was just the way that it exploded as a model. I mean, you had this like first wave of shows that were very sort of curious about human nature almost. And they had their roots in the candid camera kind of sociological model, like where people really seem to want to understand human nature a bit more. So the early wave of shows like Survivor, Big Brother, they really seemed sort of anthropological, like what would humans do in this situation? How can we better understand why people do this or behave like this? Or what happens if we put 12 people in a house together and give them lots of alcohol? Like, I'm being a bit glib, but things like that, the real world, there was this curiosity about human nature. And then as the shows proved how popular they were, and they really were incredibly popular, I think the season finale of the first season of Survivor was watched by something like 50 million people. It's the same story again. Producers saw dollar signs and they realized that the easiest way to get people to watch a new untested show would be spectacle, like provocation. What can we put on television that will be crazier than anything that's ever been on television before? This was like the late 90s, so the end of the tabloid decade. So producers came up with ideas like, what if we put 50 women on a Las Vegas stage and had them compete pageant style to marry a multimillionaire? Like, what would happen then? And obviously now it seems incredibly sexist, but it's also still kind of the model of The Bachelor a little bit, which is very much still airing. So it was sort of interesting to go back and see how much the DNA of our current era of reality television is still informed by that kind of like Jane Austen, very, very regressive model.
But an even more salient point, I think, is that it created, well, along with social media, it created the sense that to be a successful woman, you need to brand yourself. And in a very particular way, you need to brand yourself for the male gaze and go to ever greater extremes to do so, you know, to the point that I read a recent piece that you did in The Atlantic about The White Lotus, which I have been watching. That's not reality TV, but I've been watching it. And I've been struck by how the women in that show dress and move, because it is so artificial. It is so according to very strict guidelines of how women are supposed to act.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that really happened in the 2000s, and this was one of the more interesting elements of the book for me, was you no longer really had to be good at anything to become famous. There was this really change, something about reality television, it really changed the qualifications for celebrity, I think. This was also happening in a moment when the internet was really taking off and there was this curiosity for celebrity content. So the paparazzi machine was really getting really aggressive. And a lot of the A-list stars, you know, the movie stars, the Julia Roberts and the Jennifer Lopez's, they were often freaked out by how aggressive the paparazzi were. So they sort of retreated from the camera. But there was all this space to fill. There was all this space to fill on gossip blogs and in Us Weekly and In Touch magazine, which had just launched. And so this kind of new industry of not quite celebrities jumped in to fill the space. And that meant it was often reality stars. It was people who'd been on reality shows who, like I'm sure people remember how many John and Kate Plus 8 gossip magazines there were, like Us Weekly covers during the 2000s. But also people like Paris Hilton, like Kim Kardashian, women who would go to events and pose for the photographers. You know, they wouldn't run away. They wouldn't run inside. They would stop. They would pose. They would create content in lots of ways. Like, we understand that term slightly differently now in our social media age, but they created great content. And so suddenly what that meant for the rest of us, I think, was it seemed so much easier. Like, the bargain seemed to be, if we were just willing to have the plastic surgery and, you know, diet and dye ourselves orange and stand, you know, be in the right place and meet the right people, we too could become famous. That was always sort of the tease of gossip media in the 2000s. And so it was just sort of really interesting to see that shift take place and then to see in so many ways how it was priming us for the 2010s and how we would all, in fact, not become celebrities, but become content creators on social media with TikTok, with, you know, with Twitter, with MySpace, with Facebook and with Instagram very much.
And how does this then get connected to rape culture? Because I think that, you know, it just seems as if, yeah, as you said, and as we talked about before, that porn becomes actually the overarching aesthetic of our culture in some ways.
Yeah, and I think the thing about porn, it's like reality television. No one wants to take it seriously. They don't want to engage with it. They don't want to think about it. Like, it's this massive, massive, predominant cultural product of our time, but it's relatively undiscussed. I mean, there are sort of... there's definitely an element of a strong element of concern and panic now about what it's done to us after, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, but of internet porn so readily available. In terms of rape culture, yeah, I mean, chapter 3 in the book really deals with that a little bit, because I was in my late teens and 20s during the 2000s. And I just remembered very much this culture of male sexual entitlement. And I wanted for my own edification to kind of dig back into the culture of the era to see where it was coming from. And it was so clear. It was coming from everywhere. It was coming from men's magazines. I mean, Esquire magazine had a annual Women We Love issue, and it had a sidebar called Women We'd Wait For, which was about girls who were, you know, 13, 14, 15 movie stars who the men thought were attractive, but not old enough, you know, good for them. But it was everywhere. It was in movies. I mean, American Pie is in some ways such a sweet movie compared with things like Porky's from the 1980s or Revenge of the Nerds. Like, it's sort of more empathetic towards its female characters, but it's very much a hero's journey. And the hero's journey is losing virginity. And the girls are the gatekeepers. They don't sort of, the question of what they want or desire isn't given much due. They are sort of the gatekeepers of this noble passage from boy to man. And that was just so influential, I think, among the boys and the men that I knew. And it was sort of replicated throughout movies for the rest of the decade. There was like a real absence of women in movies in the 2000s. Like, women were not really characters in their own right. They were foils. They were scolds. They were, you know, annoying people who get in the way of the man's destiny. They were shrews. And I think what I've seen lately is so gratifying on that front, because we really have so many movies now that are by women, much more thoughtful about moments in women's lives, you know, becoming a mother, or ambition, or beauty standards, or, I mean, something like The Substance obviously has been endlessly debated, but that was not a movie that would have been made in the 2000s, I think, even though it would have been very relevant for the time.
So in your last chapter, Sophie Gilbert, you say that we need to rewrite the archetypes and narratives about women, and that in many ways this rewriting is already happening. I think that's part of what you just indicated. But we are also seeing the continued rise of incel misogyny, incel culture, achieving the very highest realms of our national government. An incredible backlash against women. So I wonder if you could, you know, what is going to keep women from going back to the way it was when, you know, I grew up in the 50s when women couldn't have credit cards of their own, where they couldn't sign mortgages, where, you know, the only jobs that were out there were women's jobs. You couldn't get most jobs. So how are we going to prevent that? How are we going to prevent the Handmaid's Tale?
I think what is happening is horrific in so many ways, the politics of this moment. There does seem to be a real movement among the current administration to edge women, not even edge, like shove, to push women out of the workforce and have them back in the home, subjugated by men, to have men earning money and to have women raising babies. That seems to be what this administration wants. It's very much a part of Project 2025. The flaw in the plan, I think, is that women are not going to consent to that. I mean, we're such a fundamental part of the economy as well. I mean, just looking around the women I know and the other parents I know, like, parenting is so different now. I mean, I was raised by a single mother, and I think I saw my dad on Sundays for a few hours. But looking around at my children's friends, it's everything is just more equal. And it's hard to imagine. It's very, very hard to imagine going back without real draconian requirements. And that's not to say that that can't happen. I just think practically it would be a lot to achieve. That's not to say that incel culture isn't obviously a real concern. My hope, I think, is that eventually people will realize, like men will realize, boys will realize that this culture of male worship, of sort of fraternal humor, it's just not serving them. It's not serving them. It's not giving them what they need. Like, that's sort of my hope. But the other thing that made me slightly more optimistic at the end of this book is that culture is so, it's moving all the time. Everything is always shifting and changing and responding to things and reacting. And the pattern of progress and backlash is eternal. Like it's, if we look at our history of the last 50, 60 years, it's just gone back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it will continue to do so. And what that means, I think, is that we are due another correction, like another pendulum swing. And I think at the moment, hopefully, we're seeing more mounting fury at what is happening in Washington. And I hope that we are able to harness some of that energy to sort of demand changes in 2 years and 4 years. And I hope that we have the capacity to do that. But whatever happens, nothing ever sticks for that long. So that's not to say real damage can't be done in this moment and that people shouldn't be furious and shouldn't be, you know, doing everything they can to avert disaster. But it's just to say that everything, like, change is inevitable, I think.
Well, I think that books like yours, Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned the Generation of Women Against Themselves, is a very important part of the conversations that hopefully will be able to change attitudes toward more justice and fairness on a more permanent basis, because we really have to get off this backlash merry-go-round, because each time it just seems to be ever more toxic when we go back.
Yeah, I mean, my goal with the book, I mean, obviously I would love if this book manifested a revolution. No, I mean, who wouldn't? But my goal with the book really, I wanted to understand the circumstances in which I was raised better. I wanted to understand why I had been persuaded to think so little of myself, I think, to sort of take myself so cheaply and to not understand everything I was capable of. It took me a long time to figure that out. And having sort of seen the messaging that I was given pretty much from birth onward, it makes sense now. It does make sense. And there's so much that's heartening about our current moment. There's so much that girls now have access to. There are so many voices that they can hear that are not, that, you know, that are contradicting a lot of the dominant messaging. There's so much to be There's a lot more that's awful too. I mean, social media is a real blight on many of our lives. But I do think my hope is this book is just one part of a much larger project of reconsideration of the 90s and the 2000s and the 2010s. And I do think there are so many lessons to be learned in looking back that hopefully help us create different frameworks and give us a different comprehension of our own hopes for the future.
Mm, wonderful. And it's been wonderful to talk with you, Sophie Gilbert, about this really terrific book. I'm not sure I mentioned how wonderfully written it is. I mean, you've got some epigrams in there, I think they could go into their own collection, that are just so right on.
That was the fun part for me, picking them out. And when I really, my goal throughout was to have like a highbrow one and a lowbrow one, because I think the book is constantly like dancing between those two modes. But there's nothing better than when you find the perfect quote and you're like, yes, this will set the mood for the whole chapter. It's really thrilling.
Well, thanks again, Sophie Gilbert.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Sophie Gilbert is a London-based staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers TV, books, pop culture, and entertainment. In 2024, she won the National Magazine Award for Reviews and Criticism, and she was a finalist for the 2022 Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with crime fiction master Anthony Horowitz about his new Atticus Punt mystery, Marble Hall Murders. Also, Michelle Gerber-Klein tells us about her acclaimed biography of the wife of Salvador Dali. It's called Surreal, The Extraordinary Life of Gala Dali. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.